I like that you're picking up all the microphones and saying things into them. Do you want me to do the same?
Because I'm testing them out. You see, yours sounds so much better than mine.
You know why?
Why?
Because I'm amazing.
Because you're a woman?
No, because I'm amazing, oh. Idiot. Get it straight.
Like Dwight Schrute, idiot, idiot, idiot.
Beats,
bears,
Battlestar Galactica.
Okay, people, pay attention. This is episode 17 of Podcasts for Good.
I like the demanding nature. Hey, you.
Stand up and pay attention. This is, as I said, this is episode 17 in season 1 of Podcasts for Good. I am, as always, program manager Philip Kerrigan, and this is, as always,
fiscal and policy coordinator Heather Lucas.
That's right, and we are here to talk to you about, well, it's the perfect month to talk about it, because it is, number one, Black History Month.
Yes.
And then we, of course, recently had Martin Luther King's, the celebration of Martin Luther King's birthday on Martin Luther King Day.
Yeah.
It is the perfect time to talk about racism and inequality.
Indeed.
And now, I know that that will probably send some of you running to hit the delete button, because this is such a sensitive issue, but... I think you'll find in our interview with YWCA, that's who joined us, of Olympia, that it can actually be had in a very meaningful way.
Yeah, and nobody came to blows. So
no
that's
one
good.
Came to blows, exactly. Yeah. To me, I gotta say, to me that appears to be something very much like out in the public, right? Because when you talk to individuals...
Fighting?
No, I mean fighting. Well, yes, I actually do mean fighting. But
okay.
Fighting about racism and inequality...
Sure.
Like, the real groupthink happens real fast with racism.
Yeah, kind of mob mentality, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because when you have it independently with people, mm-hmm. where you just get to have a 30, 40-minute discussion, suddenly you find that, number one, you get a little bit more educated, then they also kind of see where you're coming from, and
yeah.
it's much more, like, pleasant.
Yeah, I don't think that... I mean, I don't quite understand how if you are in a big group of people,
yeah.
getting really a message across to them is as effective when it comes to racism and inequality.
Right.
Like, I kind of feel like it's something where you're working one-on-one with people to get the most impact.
Right, because I think that people who even, like, so there are the people who are just racist.
Yeah.
Right. Well, those people, of course, are always not going to like what you.
Yeah, you're
say.
Never
going
to sell them on
right.
anything.
But even those people who don't even realize that it's happening,
yeah.
they're not going to want it to realize it in a very public space,
no,
right? They're
yeah,
going to want to realize
especially if
it,
they would yeah. feel like they're wrong.
Yes, right?
Yeah, people don't like to be told they're wrong or yeah. have any kind of conflict.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
So we actually did have one of those very interesting discussions with YWCA. We met with Cherie Reeves Spare. She's the Community Engagement and Development Director. And Racial Justice Director Lanessa Inman. And we talked to them a little bit about sexism and racism and how that organization is trying to help educate folks. So it was definitely an interesting conversation. We have reformatted the podcast, so you will hear most of our statistical stuff and all those, that sort of fun stuff, all that fun stuff.
Fun stuff,
fun
yes.
stuff. At the
statistics are so fun. Let me make sure I have a pocket protector here
yes.
and put all my statistical information inside.
Yes. Okay, hold on. I'll take this out and get my pocket calculator. I don't know why that is statistical information. Why
I don't
that
know. I pictured a guy in a bow tie
sure.
with a pocket calculator.
Okay.
Well, like Revenge of the Nerds.
Yes.
So that's
right.
where I was going.
Okay, got
yeah.
it. Got it. Not the cool nerd like Nate Silver. Like,
no.
like Revenge of the Nerds.
Like,
nerds.
yeah.
Oh, we apologize to any nerds who listen. I'm a nerd.
yeah, like, I don't feel that I'm not a nerd, so
yeah, no.
they're my people.
Yeah, you're my people, so
yeah.
don't worry about it.
Yeah.
But we do still have the question of the podcast.
We do.
Hit me with it.
All right, so I thought a little bit about the subject, and I feel that the question of the podcast is not a heavy
okay.
question,
yes.
for the most part.
It's
you
usually
know, like,
lighter fare.
Yeah. And it's also fun to give you crap.
Okay. Excellent.
So, essentially, like, what I was thinking about this
yes.
is racism and inequality are serious issues that happen to everybody.
Right.
And when it comes down to adding that element of poverty in mm-hmm. there, mm-hmm. there are people who can't go without certain things, like, you know, clean water,
right.
air,
human
shelter,
human right? rights.
And they don't, yeah, human rights. They don't exactly always get stuff like that.
Right.
And they have to fight for it, which is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But it made me kind of think of, well, like, what about us here in Olympia kind of thing? And
sure.
I thought, you know what would be a great question of the podcast?
Yeah.
Philip, what's your what's your biggest first world problem?
Oh man, that is awesome. I have so many first world problems.
Isn't it amazing? It's surprising sometimes,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
You kind of have to reel it back and be like, okay, this doesn't matter.
Yeah. Do you know how many times I've actually done that, or I've actually been literally, like I am in the red, super upset about something,
yeah.
and then you're like, you think about it, and you're like, wow, that was the stupidest thing mm-hmm. to ever get upset about.
I think that the biggest thing for me that I get in the red over is whenever I lose my phone or electronical devices.
Oh, that's
so
good
like
one.
I have an
that's
iPad, and I can easily misplace it.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever I cannot find either one of those things,
that's so good.
It just feels like life is melting.
Yes. Do you know what first world problem I experience a lot is
what?
Agree to terms and conditions.
You're like, I don't agree to these terms and conditions.
I don't understand. Like, why if I... So,
why do I have to agree to everything?
Yeah. Why do I have to agree to everything? I'm just going to agree. Just assume I agree.
Yeah.
Right?
And I want to use this product.
Right. I clearly want to. You're going to hit me with...
I'm here for a reason.
You're going to hit me with the terms and conditions. You know I'm not going to read them.
Yeah.
Right? So just don't even hit me with them in the first place.
Well, yeah, and with terms and conditions, I mean, like... There was an episode of South Park where, you know, terms and conditions weren't read for the Apple contract, and, like, one of the kids ended up as a human centipede. So things could happen. They could write really crazy things into terms and conditions, but how
that,
enforceable
is
some of that? You know?
I agree. Yeah, that's one that always kind of drives me a little nuts, is terms and conditions.
Yeah.
You and Jerrica obviously know my feeling on bicyclists. I have a lot of first world problems with bicyclists.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the
apologies to bicyclists.
Yes, please pay attention. It's just me. It's my thing. It's not your thing.
No,
I totally understand. It's an irrational thing that I have going on.
Yeah.
But one of the things that always tends to happen is like I will go into a left turn lane.
Yeah.
Right. It's got the arrow.
Yeah.
And I will inevitably be sitting behind a bicyclist who imagines himself to be like a Honda Civic.
Sure.
And so they're in that lane.
Uh-huh.
And then when the light hits and they don't go, like, right away, I'm like, oh, mother, you need to go.
I have a driving one, too, though.
Yeah?
Yeah. So I cannot handle it. If you're in the left lane for any reason and you're not passing somebody, I can't function.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it makes me road rage. So I need you...
Oh, you mean like slow?
No, I need you to follow the rules,
okay?
The left lane is a passing lane, the right lane is a driving lane.
Yeah,
get
yeah.
out of the left lane. And I don't even care if I'm going, you know, if I'm in the left lane or the right lane. If somebody's just like idling in the left lane, like I can't handle it.
Right.
And I just want to gun it and then pass them or get away from them. Just be like, oh, you're driving me crazy, get away from me. Yeah.
That's a good one, too. Yeah. I like that one.
Can't handle it.
Yeah, that's a good one. My car is currently a first world problem, just in general. It's just a heap of first world problems. It's
just not pasted together.
Just all together.
To get you from point
it's
A to B.
It's the worst first world problems of all time. All of them. Like, it sounds bad, you know, like the heat doesn't come on. I mean, just first world problems everywhere with that car. It should just be called the Ford First World Problem.
Nice, nice. And if they don't come out
shout
with
out
an official...
Shout out to Ford, sponsor the show.
And if Ford doesn't come out with an official car called First World Problem, you could actually be like, you know what, I've named my car.
It's the Ford First World Problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like it.
That's a great question. So,
and you're welcome.
Oh, thank you. So here's what we're going to do, people. What we're going to do is we're going to transition now into the interview with YWCA of Olympia. Once again, Cherie Reeves-Spare, she's the Community Engagement and Development Director, and Racial Justice Director, Lanessa Inman. Here we go. All right, so we're actually joined here by Community Engagement and Development Director, Cherie Reeves-Spare, and Racial Justice Director, Lanessa Inman from the YWCA of Olympia. Thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So let's get started with a simple question. Can you give us a little bit of a history of the YWCA in Olympia?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, surprisingly, a lot of people don't know that we've been around since 1945. We've been in the same building since 1945.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
So our mission is to eliminate racism and sexism, to advance the political, social, and economic status of all women and girls. And we do this through issue education, mm-hmm. advocacy here in the Capitol, as well as program and direct services. So we've been doing it a really, really long time. Everything that we do is wrapped up in what we call a platform area. Our platform areas are empowerment and economic advancement, health and safety of all women and girls, and racial justice.
Awesome, awesome.
Nice. So in regards to the platforms you just talked about, what does your organization do for the community for the in terms of the platforms?
Each of the platforms comes with a different advocacy area. For example, economic empowerment is Equal Pay Opportunity Act, which is on the Hill right now, 5140, which is in the Senate and we're following. But it's also about issue education, so some of these podcasts that we come and we talk about. But there's also direct services like our Girls Without Limits Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math program, our Workplace Equity Initiative, Kathleen's Closet, which is a clothing distribution center for women, our Youth Advisory Board, our Social Empowerment Economic Advancement Network, as well as our program called the Women's Economic Empowerment Program. Fabulous program. It's a gender-responsive work skills program 4 days a week, but really focuses on healing and trauma-informed services for women who are seeking employment.
Awesome. So I think the big thing is of course, right now, this conversation surrounding racism and sexism is obviously pretty topical in terms of we're finally starting to see real voices that actually probably would never honestly be courageous enough to speak out, right? And so it's changing the narrative a little bit, but it always leaves people wondering locally. You know, we see the national picture, of course. Locally, what does racism, sexism, what does it really look like here locally? What are you guys tackling? What sort of issues do you see?
Well, after about 4 years of really, rigorous internal work at the YWCA, historically, we were involved with racial justice work, as our mission is eliminating racism and empowering women. But there were kind of a couple decades, actually, where half of our mission wasn't really addressed. And so it was about 4 years ago that we decided that we really needed to address racism in our community of Thurston County, and specifically Olympia at the time. So before even going there, we really did a lot of internal work, and that's something that we've modeled, and we actually created a program called Intercultural Foundations after that model. But the basically the outcome of that is today we have a framework that's basically under an intersectional feminist model, and so those are like looking at the intersections of injustice and oppression through the lens of feminism. And so as we could look at just, you know, issues addressing sexism as we had for a while at YWCA, we really started to look at how does, you know, variance of gender and gender non-conforming youth and individuals intersecting with sexism and racism, you know, classism, poverty, all of those things. So as far as like how we really address it here locally is through a variance of different platforms. Sheree mentioned a few, and as I'd said, Intercultural Foundations is a program that is kind of the outcome of a lot of the work that we did. So basically, this is a program that we have a team of three, and we basically focus on assessing and building intercultural competency within groups and individuals and various organizations throughout the community. So we do this by measuring five core mindsets and associated behaviors, utilizing a cross-culturally validated intercultural competency assessment tool called the IDI. It's all a lot of technical terminology.
Yeah.
But basically what this does is this actually allows us to have a picture of our intercultural competency level as a group, because we tend to over-perceive where we might be at. So then when we have that picture, we create really rigorous and responsive development plans for those groups. So we're currently working within a couple of education institutions, two nonprofits. We're starting a project in a construction company.
Oh, nice.
So we actually have a variance of different groups in different sectors who are really prioritizing the work. Mm-hmm. And then also a different route that we take within Intercultural Foundations is not just through training, education, and awareness,
right.
but it's also going to, it's a three-phase process. So phase one, phase two. Phase three actually addresses structural inequities,
mm-hmm.
and so for us that's really important. While we tend to typically focus on interpersonal racism and instances of discrimination, which are obviously a huge problem,
sure.
we also have large and existing and very local problems of institutional racism and oppression.
Sure.
So do you find that after you guys looked at the way that you were doing things and changed the model a little bit more intersectional between racism, inequality, sexism, and things like this,
mm-hmm.
with that intersection, do you find that people are really responding better to it?
Absolutely. It completely changed really everything about our organization.
Yeah.
It definitely, a lot of times, you know, we think about, well, we need to diversify. We need more people of color to, you know, be represented in, say, education, for example. Before we get there, we really need to look at the actual culture and are we actually perpetuating oppression within our organization. And even though half of our mission is eliminating racism, we weren't really emulating that with
mm-hmm.
some of our practices.
Right.
So our retention has completely gone up with staff.
Yeah.
People love coming to work. It's a very inclusive environment.
Nice.
Definitely healthy and safe environment, which is really important in these times,
right.
especially.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So I have a question, an off-the-board question. We kind of like to have a conversation that is beyond maybe your standard sort of talking points, right? Because that's
mm-hmm.
all that ever exists
sure.
in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So can you kind of elaborate on sort of, because we know the statistics associated with females,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think the conversation around racial wage gap is really ever talked about.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
We talk about it a lot, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Equal Pay Day, which is that day in the year that women have to work until they equal to what men in the previous year earned.
Right.
Okay, so
yeah.
right now, for all women, that day is April 10th.
Okay.
So April 10th, we're going to work through April 10th to make the same wage.
Somebody
that,
makes
that
from
men.
January, yes. Yeah.
Right. Now, if I am a black woman, I'm going to work until July.
Okay.
Wow.
If I am a Latina woman, I'm going to work till November.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we absolutely talk about it. And that's part of the work that we're doing. That's part of the Equal Pay Opportunity Act. That's part of the wage disparity acts that
mm-hmm.
have been coming through. And so, yeah, absolutely. We talk about it a lot. We instituted it within our own organization as well. We think about these things and we talk about them. Lanessa really, you know, she really tipped on to something that you don't hear a lot of folks say in the nonprofit world, and that is, you know, we didn't do it right for several years. We weren't doing
yeah.
it right. We really didn't focus on it. So this time to take where we really step back and said, where are we? What are we perpetuating?
Mm-hmm.
Are we engaging in pay gaps?
Right.
That were also
right.
related to that.
Yeah.
And there are other pay gap. There are other pay gaps as well. Ableism is a very real thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
Ageism.
Yeah.
We really took a long, hard look at ourselves.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that in Intercultural Foundations, one of the things I think is really important is that it's not just a checklist, easy, here, you're going to have one session, you're going to go through a six-hour training, and you're done. You're culturally competent. Because we're still working through it.
Yeah.
We've been doing it for 3 years.
Right.
And we are still working through it.
Right.
But if it's the right thing to do and it's the just thing
mm-hmm.
to do, it is what you do.
This kind of sounds like, based on what you guys have in terms of the system you're building, your goal seems like to be able to go to a business or an organization and essentially educate them into the fact that, hey, you guys are not necessarily hitting the benchmarks you need to hit. Have you noticed that businesses or organizations respond and then go, man, we should probably actually get this wage gap figured out? Or have you guys seen any of that come into play?
That's a great question. Do you want to take that or...
Yeah, Intercultural Foundations, the wage gap is part of it, so we do have an entire different, like, wage gap initiative.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of like the phase three conversation that we might have with, for instance, a group of directors. If we've been working with them for about 18 months,
right.
we look at all of those things, and it definitely differs. I think as organizations kind of do the assessment part, there's a lot of these, like, wake-up moments of, like, oh, wow, because what we're doing is centering the voices and needs and experiences of those individuals. It could be employees, it could be program participants who are experiencing disparities and oppression. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a large learning curve that happens that could be the result of various different kind of reasons that they call us in. Some of that is because it's just what's the good thing to do. You know, like we want to ensure that this is an equitable, inclusive workplace. Sometimes it's in response to actual allegations of sexual harassment or racism. And then also there's a lot more research that's coming out about intercultural competency and equity just being like, I think it's the top four best practices and an, actually an indicator of successful outcomes for private businesses.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So there's a very...
I can tell you from a personal standpoint, there have been numerous times where I've been involved with like groups, right?
Mm-hmm.
Really good one is design work. So I'll design a poster or I'll design a series of posters and then I'll show it to everybody and they'll be like, what is missing on here? And you'll go, oh, wow, because it's not, for me, right? It's an honest mistake. I'll be like, oh, well, I'm the designer. I'm designing with my eye. Unless I really actually take a step outside and actually think about it, being intentional about what I'm going to portray out there, it can happen. It's really interesting how easy it can happen.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, people fall into patterns. Well, you know, in some people's cases, it's harmless, but in other people's cases, it's they do it with intention. They want they want it to be
like hurtful.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they
yeah.
do it. They do it hurtfully. Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, even with the best of intentions, we're really socialized to minimize differences.
Yeah.
You know, to cope if we don't really know how or what to say or how to bridge that gap, and that leaves a lot of real issues if we have, you know, a table full of people making decisions that impact others that aren't represented. It can be really detrimental.
So how would you guys suggest talking to kids about racial issues, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the biggest things, I have three kids, and after specifically after Charlestown, I found it very difficult to articulate exactly what happened there so that the mind of a six-year-old could get what was going on. Because for my six-year-old, apparently, you know, for me, I feel like the kids actually kind of get it.
Yeah.
There's no politics involved on the playground, right? They'll play with whoever wants to play with them. But how would you guys talk about addressing those sort of things with kids?
Well, obviously, it's a something that should be handled. I wouldn't say you know, sometimes we think it has to be this big formal thing. The more you can normalize it and integrate it into every day, it could be driving down the road and, oh, have you noticed, you know, anything different about this area or something?
Yeah.
They are noticing it, like you said.
Right.
So to not make it this big, heavy subject.
Just to talk about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think really asking questions, you know, what have you noticed? Definitely integrating, you know, diverse reading books. I just had a friend contact me and she asked, you know, My son's turning one. I want him to have, you know, like regular books that have like a good representation of people of color.
Yeah.
So really normalizing it, but I think asking questions. What do you observe? What do you hear?
Yeah.
What are your friends' experience?
Okay.
And there's definitely lots of resources online, as well as you could contact us and we could send you a, you know, resource list.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think just initially having the conversation. And my son's 15 and, you know, he's dark skinned, so we talk about it a lot and we always have.
Right.
But he's definitely noticing that a lot more of the white students in his school are just having these conversations. So.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I think is good.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, I think that's the only way that it actually changes.
Right.
But it is always interesting to me because I've read some things that have said basically like, you know, like don't say anything about it. Treat everybody as if they're the same. You're
Whoa.
Like, oh my gosh, no, that's...
Yes.
Because they're going to notice it. They do notice it.
Absolutely.
Almost right away, you know.
Yeah, it's one of those, and that's kind of an example we use with intercultural foundations, is minimization looks like, oh, you know, I raised my kids to be colorblind, and that's actually really
how do you do that?
Yeah, yes. How can you possibly do that?
Yes,
right?
Yeah. That's the opposite of centering marginalized individuals, and so we can't pretend like everything's equal, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Right. And well, and that is what ends up being kind of the really cool part about where we live, is that it is so diverse. We should actually try and, you know, play on that diversity and the strengths of the other of others.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? I think that's a big deal.
And there's opportunities all around us. Like for people who are going to listen to this podcast, there is something happening in the Rotunda right now that has I don't know what they're doing, but I heard drums and I heard people singing.
Yeah.
So like there's all kinds of instances of breaking out of just your little worldview, your tiny culture box, to experience other things. And like, if you don't talk about it with kids, they're probably not going to get any kind of idea how do I move forward with this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And or they're going to be ill-informed.
Right. And they also see the way you interact with people as well.
And think that that's how they should act as well. Yeah.
Let's take a break from our interview to officially thank all of our volunteers and donors for making 2017 another incredible year. As a result of your efforts and amazing giving, we were able to reach $5.4 million in pledged money, making it the highest campaign since 2010. We also increased over 500 donors. And our volunteer tracker logged more than 11,000 hours, saving charities more than 300,000 through the volunteerism of our state employees. It was by far the most we've ever logged since starting our tracking app in 2013. We couldn't have done any of this without you, our volunteers and donors. For more information on how your agency did, how your division fared in your county, or even how many volunteer hours employees at your agency logged, visit our campaign tracker at www.cfd.wa.gov/cfd/campaign-tracker. And now, back to the interview.
So, Ron Hoskins at the Brookings Institute testified before Congress in June 2012, and he said that only 2% of the population that's in poverty has these three attributes. They've completed a high school education, they work full-time, and they wait until the age of 21 to get married and have a baby. In your experience, do you feel that these are effective rules, or does this sound out of touch? Does that make sense?
Like, if you're experiencing poverty, apparently those three things, if you have those three things, you have a better chance of being middle class as opposed to in the poverty, like way below poverty line. Yeah.
Now, where does the race come into play for that, I think? The race and gender.
You know, I think it's kind of hard to answer some of that without actually reviewing the material
first.
And
right.
Had that,
that's a good answer. I love that answer because nobody says that anymore. They just spout off and say, "Whoa, I'll tell you what."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, that's part of what we've really
I think that's
learned
a good point.
Over the process.
Absolutely.
Is that without having that in front of us to make a really thoughtful response to that, I think it's unfair, and without listening to the voices of the individuals who they are referring to, and rather than just generalizations that are put out there, I think that's an unfair, it'd be unfair to answer it fully. I don't...
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, just generally, I think anything that doesn't factor in race doesn't mean that there's not an element of race impacting those disparities. And so just because an individual, whether it was based on a study that was done independently, whatever that was, sometimes things are just left out. And sometimes it is intentional, or it's minimized, or it's not done correctly. I mean, research is such a really precarious thing to do well anyway.
Yeah,
I'd be really interested to, to learn more about that.
Yeah, he had talked about it being something that was three things that continually show up for people who escape, like, ultimate poverty, and they move into a higher class, and that was that they had waited until over 21 to get married and have a baby, and then they had their high school education, and that they also worked full-time. Now, I mean, like, working full-time, it does definitely give somebody, like, more of an upper hand to get out of poverty.
Right.
But still, like, if you're, say, a parent, you're going to have to take that money and put it right back into childcare, which could bring you back down into a poverty that you don't intend to stay at.
I think the fault with a study like that as well is that it's saying, here's the three things, and if you do these three things,
you'll be
successful.
Fine.
It's like one of those BuzzFeed things on social media, right? These five things are what you need to do.
And I think that just perpetuates dominant culture as well, because it puts people into a box that is what this researcher perceives to be the issue, and the nature of success is defined by that particular researcher. So I think that's one of those things you want to be really careful of and mindful of, really reading and thoughtfully reading and analyzing that kind of research.
And this guy testified in front of Congress in 2012 saying that.
Wow.
So whoever was in Congress at the time and whoever he testified in front of, they went forward from that place thinking, okay, these are three things we've got to make sure people get. Otherwise,
poverty. Might be one of those issues of representation. I just take a guess.
Yeah, probably. So I ask this question to almost every single guest that comes on the podcast that is dealing with a very topical issue that has seemingly been entrenched for a long time. do you see things, do you have optimism for where we are today versus where we have been in the past? Do you think we're moving in the right direction? Or have we actually taken a step maybe backwards? Or are we just spinning our wheels? What do you guys think?
I think my observation, both personally as a person of color and a woman, and then also just in doing this work, it's kind of both. I think that for people with marginalized identities, we've definitely had this reality that we grow up knowing about, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, having to coach our kids and how to interact with law enforcement when they're, you know, really young, or how to move through a grocery store. So there's that like regular knowledge to experiencing racism and harassment and discrimination. But again, there's this bigger thing of like entrenched oppression and systemic mm-hmm. oppression and institutional racism that I think a lot of people who are white or not impacted by that can just move through the world without really knowing it's there. I think it's really getting ripped up, like the Band-Aid's coming off. We're seeing how things really haven't mm-hmm. changed as yeah. much. And I think some of those systems right now, to be honest, are being empowered. And so it is actually kind of scary.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we're hearing from a lot more people the demand for this program. For example, we're at full capacity and can't even entertain taking on more projects right now, whereas a couple of years ago it was just like trying to, you know, encourage people why to do this work. And so I think that with a lot of the movements that have been happening, you know, Me Too and all of these things where employees and individuals are feeling more empowered to speak up, and we're just not tolerating these issues yeah. anymore. So that's good, but also it is kind of the sense of kind of going backwards, you know, structurally and institutionally.
So you guys have been doing this work specifically, the work you're doing now, for about 3 years, you said? 4 years?
Yeah, 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
Yeah, we really started about 4 years ago.
So with that, I mean, do you feel like we're in a trendy space where this is something that people care about? The movements, they care about what happened in Ferguson and Charlottesville, and they care about the Me Too movement, and then it's no longer news and they stop caring? Or do you think that we're at a point where we're not going back?
I certainly hope
right.
we're not going back.
Right, right.
You know, I guess one thing that I look at, and I don't want to dominate this, Sheree, but I kind of compare my 15-year-old sometimes, mm-hmm. which is kind of difficult to do because the internet, I'll just disclose my age. It was just coming out when I was his age.
Yep.
And so I was, you know, politically active at that age, but not as much. And I think that's both unfortunate, you know, for how exposed our kids are today.
Yeah.
The change I have seen is that the young people who we work with, the things that I hear my son and his friends talk about, I'm just mind blown and so encouraged.
Nice.
Yeah.
Because while it is kind of horrific that they're seeing, you know, I
these
didn't
sort
see.
Of things.
Yeah, exactly. They're really, I think there's a larger resistance against this kind of, you know, mindset
yeah.
of discrimination
yeah.
and inequality.
Right. Nice.
Yeah, I tend to think that too. I think that what ends up happening is when traditional power structures, traditional things are challenged, when they need to be challenged,
yeah.
what tends to happen is there is this length of time where those power structures can feed off of fear or paranoia or those sort of things, and they can survive for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, you see enough movement to where those things sort of change, and it happens so gradual sometimes that you just basically one day wake up and it's different than it was.
Right.
And I think that that's what we're experiencing now. You have
mm-hmm.
vestiges of an old sort of status quo, who still get to hang on because they are able to, you know, kind of make the game work for them a bit. But that will change. I mean, I imagine you guys have seen more women running for elected office, or more women even interested in politics. And those are sort of the places for change, no?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're absolutely seeing that. We have actually women who call us to find out how they're going to run. They're calling us as a resource to
wow.
find out how they can get involved in the political process.
Mm-hmm.
Our advocacy committee has grown. We have a really active advocacy committee that's up to 15 individuals right now. But really, people are running, and there's this groundswell behind them, and people are voting. That's the other thing, is people are voting.
Yeah.
And I think that this next election in 2020 is going to be huge.
Yeah.
This is going to be a big one. We still have to get through a lot of things like voter registration, gerrymandering, but we are going to see big...
I think that'll be a huge litmus test. I think you're right. I think that'll be where we see... Because the women's march at that point will have happened for how many years at that point? Four.
In 2012?
By then it'll have been four. That was really the first time, I think... You could notice the really like, okay, there's a foundation here. It exists. What is going to be interesting is to see from here on out how like that changes the political dynamic. Because some of those folks who went to women's march have got to run for office.
Yes.
You know, because otherwise no power gets gained. You know what I mean?
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's say somebody listens to the podcast and they want to start giving to YWCA of Olympia. What do donations do for you guys? What do you do with donations?
Oh, well, this is great because, you know, we have a CFD number.
Yes.
I always put that on here, which is 0315497.
That's
YWCA CFD number. What's really great is that it comes right out of the workplace check, which is really phenomenal. But what it does is something really powerful. We have individuals who are donating $10 a month. That's a total of $120 per year, which does a lot for us. One example is that it really fortifies our youth advisory board, which is working on sexual harassment right now.
Awesome.
It provides staffing. It provides, believe it or not, snacks for that group. It provides transportation. They were out doing signature gathering for De-Escalate Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Powerful engagement in the political process as well. Even $25 a month, which is going to bring in $300 for us. You could send a kid to a Girls Without Limits science, technology, engineering camp for an entire week with that. And I will tell you that we had 80% of our last camp participants requested a scholarship. 80%.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't do it without the help of others. But
right.
I'll be frank with you as well. We do other things. You can get, you know, if you're doing $5 a week, you're buying five diapers every week. And the generosity of our community is huge. And the other bank serves over 13,000 people every year. 90% of those contributions come to us, but the reality is we still have to keep the doors open. We still have to keep the lights on.
Yeah.
We still have to find baggies so that we can break down boxes of diapers and other individual products. Those are the kind of things that people can help us with. I will tell you, if you have somebody out there who wants to give us $10 a month, that will keep us in baggies so that we can serve more individuals with those contributions.
Mm.
With those big boxes of things that come in from Costco,
sure.
We break down menstrual products into packs of 14. So $10 a month is going to help us make that happen for the entire year. That's pretty profound.
Awesome.
But there's also bigger things as well. You know, you can help a woman go through the economic empowerment program with just a $50 contribution each month. It's really huge.
Cool.
And so I'm going to go back and just say 0315497 is our CFD number. We'd love to have you.
We also
have great opportunities for volunteers as well.
Awesome.
Nice.
Awesome.
Nice.
Do you guys have anything coming up?
We do. We've got a couple of really cool things happening. We've got our Mission Impact Luncheon. It is a relatively new event for us.
Mm-hmm.
Get this, tickets are only $10, and you're going to get a great vegan meal with this as well. It's going to be on Wednesday, February 21st, which is next week at 11:30 a.m. at the Lacey Community Center. This is a pretty casual, laid-back kind of day, but we are going to talk about the issues we've talked about. We're
cool.
going to
right
let
on.
People know what we're doing. What is our vision for 2020? What does a just society look like?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to eat. We want people to come in because we've done so much change and growth in the last 4 years. That we want people, I'm tired of people saying, oh, you do that?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I didn't know you did that.
Right.
Well, we're going to tell you what that is, and we're going to eat some good food. So anybody at CFD, and I have to tell you, there's a state group that's coming.
Yeah?
Yeah, there's a couple of them.
That's awesome.
I got a call from someone saying, we've got a whole group of us that we want to get a table.
Yeah, cool.
So,
nice.
Yeah, and they're CFD friends of ours.
Yes. Love it.
Great. it's great. There's a lot of really great things that people do with their support.
Awesome.
Nice. But you know the other thing you do? You follow us on social media. And when I put up something that says you call about Equal Pay Day or make a call to your center, you do those kind of things. And you come over and you volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
We have lots of events. We need help at events. Give us a call.
Awesome.
Right on.
Awesome. Well, Cherie, Lanessa, thank you guys so much for joining us on the podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. And if any of your listeners have questions, give us a call.
Mm-hmm.
Check us out online, ywcaofolympia.org.
Cool. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Okay, so that was the interview with Cherie Reeves-Spare and Lanessa Inman with YWCA of Olympia. Very interesting conversation that I think hit on a bunch of different topics.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really good. I thought they really, I mean, that's not usually the way these sort of conversations go, so that was really nice.
Yeah.
So the major thing that came up during the interview, and we wanted to kind of articulate it, was this question that... that came from Ron Haskins at the Brookings Institute. We want to... I thought it was really refreshing that Cherie said what she said during the interview.
Yeah.
That she didn't know and she didn't want to comment on something she hadn't taken a look at. I think more people ought to do that in real life.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people just do that thing where if somebody asks them something, they feel they have to respond in some kind of positive, uplifting way.
Yes.
Which means, I know the answer.
Yeah.
From the most part, because like, you're not supposed to.
I loved it.
Do
I mean,
that,
because
right?
I think too many people go, "Yeah, I know the answer to that question," and then BS their way through some answer.
And then you have to find out later, like, "Well, you didn't know what you were talking about,
right.
and
right.
you couldn't make this happen. So
yep.
why didn't you just tell me that in the first place?"
Right. So you were the one who kind of dove into that question, Heather. Why don't you tell us what this information really means, what it was
sure.
intended for.
Yeah, so this particular gentleman was talking about poverty
mm-hmm.
in front of Congress.
Right.
So in June 2012, and I'll quote him here, he said, "Young people can virtually assure that they and their families will avoid poverty if they follow three elementary rules for success. Complete at least a high school education,
yeah.
work full-time, and wait until age 21 and get married before having a baby. Based on an analysis of census data, people who followed all three of these rules had only a 2% chance of being in poverty and a 72% chance of joining the middle class, defined as above $55,000 in 2010.
Wow.
So that's what he said to Congress. Now,
wow.
I mean, like
that
I said...
That doesn't seem like... I mean, there seems to be so many other variables that would actually come
well,
to play.
Well, yeah, out. I mean, because, like, okay, you have a high school education, so that
right.
means that you could probably get a better paying job than if you didn't.
Yeah.
If you... waited until you got married and had a kid, then you have a little more money to, say, establish a life.
Yeah.
But what about any other variable in the world? The economy?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the city that you live in?
Right.
If the city you live in doesn't have jobs, you have to leave your city and go somewhere
right.
else. You know, there's just a lot more variables, I think. And
yeah, yeah. It's an interesting one because I think... And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of the reasons why you were bringing it up and why this was a valid question was the question of how race plays into poverty.
Yeah.
Because according to this guy...
You just have to work full-time, have a high school education...
Doesn't matter what your race
and
is.
Then wait until 21 to be married and have a baby.
Right.
Yeah, if you have those three things...
You're good to go. You have a
yeah.
98% chance of being in the middle class.
Yeah.
That seems
72%.
Oh, excuse me, 72%.
Yeah, I mean that's still really good.
That's still unbelievable.
Yeah.
So that I found really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, and I think it was really interesting how they responded to it because I did think that Cherie was really fair. She said, you know, I don't really know that particular
yeah.
report, and a lot of times maybe statistics are manipulated or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's I thought that was really interesting. When I read it, I was like, really? What?
So, I thought it was a strange thing
yeah.
to go in front of Congress and say.
Yeah, well, it's an even stranger number if it's actually correct.
Yeah, I mean, 72% of people who do those three things, they have a 70, like, I don't
know. It's pretty weird.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem correct to me.
No.
And also, like, you see it all the time. There has to be some element of race and some element of gender
yeah.
involved in poverty. It can't.
Because I'm sure that if you talk about, say, a married, two parents married, and they have these high school education, work full-time, and they waited
yeah.
to have a baby,
yeah.
Versus one person who was married after 21,
yeah.
but is now divorced, like... The poverty level, like,
yeah.
they're not going to be the same.
I know. That's interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So, do you have some stats and figures about racism and inequality here in Washington State, Ms. Lucas?
I do, but they also revolve around poverty.
Okay.
So, I think poverty is one of those things that people think, well, if you're poor, it's because you didn't try hard enough.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, so poverty is not just it's not just a class issue or like a wealth issue. Mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. It is a racism issue as well. So there is, like, we had talked a little intersectionalism. So in Washington State in September 2014, apparently Washington was declining as far as our income.
Okay.
As of 2015, 2016, it started to go back up.
Okay.
So we all started to make just a little more money.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's excellent.
As of 2014, the Washington State Budget and Policy Center had this really slick infographic here.
Yeah, that does look slick.
It is slick.
Man,
we should probably steal the graphics on
here.
Holy
cow, Jerrica Ferguson, yeah. Step your game
and
up.
And see, look at some of the colors on here are very CFD.
I know.
So I'm just saying, we should steal this.
Yeah, we should.
Thank you, Washington State Budget and Policy Center. Shout out. Want to be a sponsor on the podcast?
Yeah, come on.
So in Washington State, poverty by the numbers, 1 in 15 people lived in deep poverty. So that means that they made $9,765 a year or less.
Oh my gosh.
1 in 15.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
Right? And that 1 in 7 live in poverty. So poverty is defined as $19,530 or less. And that was in 2014.
Yeah, that to me. Can I also tell you, I think that number's crazy. I think that
yeah,
it's,
poverty should not be that low.
Yeah, it being that
low.
That
seems deep poverty, honestly.
Yeah. I don't think that these numbers... I've thought that for a long time. I don't think these numbers accurately reflect, like, what it takes to live.
Yeah, man. Because, I mean, on the backside of this infographic, they talk about the monthly cost of living. So, like, food is $536 a month. Childcare, $917. Housing, $906. If your childcare is more than your housing, which is kind of a standard practice
Yes, it
days,
is. Yes, it is.
That's crazy.
I know.
And that's hard to do.
I know. It's perpetuating a cycle too. I think one of the things that happens with the gender conversation mm-hmm. specifically, and we didn't get a chance to bring it up, is this concept of if you're a female,
yeah,
and you're trying to make it in, you know, you're trying to climb the corporate ladder, quote unquote,
sure,
right? You and yet you also want to start a family, mm-hmm. right? Those still to this day seem to be diametrically opposed to each other.
Yeah.
In a way that I think I'm not sure how we get over that, because you take months off to take care of your newborn child.
Yeah.
The man is not expected to do the same.
Yeah.
Right? And so...
So your career kind of stalls for a bit.
So your career stalls, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you enter back into the workplace, you will enter in at less money than that guy who worked five extra months than you did in the office, or a year, or let's say you're like a lot of women who are doing some mathematical analysis and are like, I could just not work and take care of my kid and probably save the money.
Yeah, and then that also stalls your career. So if something were to happen, like if you got divorced... later on and had to get a job after, or if your kids grew up and you decided, hey, mm-hmm. I want to work again,
yep.
then you're starting at a disadvantage.
You enter right back in near the bottom or where you started.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, everybody else evolved over time. They got different positions, whatever. So that is going to have to be something that will go hand in hand. I mean, my wife experiences that now. Mm-hmm. So she got this promotion at her work. It's more money. She's number two at her work.
Yeah.
The number one also happens to be female, so you have this great sort of modern power structure that people are striving for.
Yeah.
But even my wife with three kids is facing that notion of like, well, I'm not home.
Yeah.
Right? I want to be by my kids, but I'm only going to be with my kids in the evenings.
Yeah.
Right? So even she struggles with it, because if she were to give up now
and
say, I'm done, I want to go take care of my kids, she would instantly lose any growth potential she has.
Absolutely, yeah. And she'd start over way lower than she ended up at.
Right.
So speaking of kids.
Yeah.
In Washington State, more kids of color live in low-income households. So for children under 18 who live below the poverty level, the majority of them in our state, mm-hmm. 65%, are Latino.
Oh, wow.
60% are considered Black, 59% are considered American Indian mm-hmm. or Alaska Native,
wow.
and 36% are multiracial, so say
yeah,
you're more than
races.
One
wow.
race, and then 30% are Asian and Pacific Islander. Also, 30% are white. And then I found this other graph that talked about poverty in as far as race goes for the United States, and there was a study done at the University of Wisconsin. And they'd been tracking race all the way back into, like, the 50s.
Yeah.
Okay, so it was like all races put into one
okay.
in the 50s, and then they start breaking it out a little by certain races.
Okay,
so
okay.
you've got a little detail. For the rates in, it looks like 2013, a little after 2013, people who identify as Black or African American, they are experiencing 31.6% of the population experiences poverty.
Mm. Wow.
So a third
oh my gosh.
Of anybody who identifies as Black or African American.
That's incredible.
I know,
in
right?
the nation.
Yeah, in the nation.
Holy crap.
So, that's insane.
Yeah.
Hispanic people, they are close behind, 28.9%.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow.
So, those are the top two races who experience the most poverty.
Yeah.
And then white races, people who identify as white, are 17.2.
Okay.
So, they're the next closest.
Yeah.
But if a third of the population is saying, yeah, this is the income I have,
yeah,
and it's below the poverty line,
right.
or it's close to it,
yeah.
That how do you come back from that?
No, that's the biggest argument. Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of astounding. And
yeah.
like we had mentioned, we talked a little bit about wage gaps.
Mm-hmm.
So I had heard too, like I don't know scientifically any stats or anything, but that yeah, any kind of woman who is white, like, you're going to experience a wage difference between a man who is white.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it comes to women who are different ethnicities, they're going to, it's going to be a lot more.
Right.
Yeah, so, like, if a woman is making 50 cents compared to a man,
yeah.
but then a Hispanic woman is going to be making 20 cents instead
oh,
of that 50.
Yeah, well, she kind of articulated that in that whole, like, a woman has to work till April. To get what a man has got from January to December.
Yeah.
Right? So she'd have to work January to the next April.
Yeah, to make the
to
same
equal
money.
The same 1 year.
And a woman who's Hispanic would have to work almost two full years
yeah.
for that white man's 1 year.
That's nuts. That's nuts.
Yeah. I mean, like, we're in government.
Yeah. So
while
it's
being in charity, but at the same time, like, how is that happening?
I know. It's really crazy to me. I just don't understand.
I mean, like, I understand that. You know, for government salaries, so you've got to
mm-hmm.
set your salary, you've got to be at a position, you know,
yeah.
there's a very
yeah.
bureaucratic rah, rah,
right.
rah, 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 about it, right?
Yeah.
But I don't doubt that that's not happening in government.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too prevalent, it seems.
Yeah, that's really weird.
Yeah.
All right, so that was actually a great interview. So what we're going to do now is just talk to you a little bit about upcoming events around the state, and then we'll close. So the major things, of course, are still the recognition events. We
yeah.
just did Spokane's. It was really a good time. We had three different local coordinators went out in Spokane.
Nice job, Spokane.
Very cool job, Spokane. And then we will have the Thurston County recognition event on March 2nd at the Little Creek Casino out in Shelton. The Snohomish King, otherwise known as Snow King, will be on March 15th. Up at the Shoreline, the old Shoreline High School, I think
yeah,
it was.
Yeah, yeah.
Old Shoreline High School. And then we are still TBD on Whatcom. Hold tight, Bellingham people. We are going to do this. I promise you. We're looking into the venues now. An exciting piece of news that we will start to share as we get closer to when this happens is one of the cool things that came out of our Spokane visit was that the local United Way out in Spokane and Second Harvest, which is essentially the Northwest Harvest for the east side,
yeah.
Agreed to do Well Fed, Well Read in Spokane. So we're actually literally expanding the program, for those of you who know it, down here in Olympia, out to other areas of the state. And the vision is in about 5 years to have this thing going off
all over the place
yeah. to where it's like the time to help your local food bank and your local reading foundation. So it's going to
yeah.
be cool. It'll be really cool.
I like it.
So that's it, folks. Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate you listening to the pod, and tune in next time. Oh, by the way, one last thing, though. I do have to say one last thing.
All right.
Go to iTunes. If you listen to us through iTunes, I want you to subscribe. And then, if you've already done that, I want you to review us. Because the more you review us, the higher up we get into the little thing.
Oh, so
shout out to you, Landon Baldwin.
Hey.
Review us and give us a good one. All right, folks. So that's it for us. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.